You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Rob Walker. I'm in London to investigate a mystery. It's a story that contains some disturbing details, and it began right here on this quiet suburban street on a September morning last year.
It was a sunny day. It was hot, in fact. Being it was a Sunday morning, I was having a lay-in, of course.
It was a hot, sunny day and we were planning to have a barbecue.
It was 7:42 in the morning because I always check the time when I wake up, see whether the kids have woken up early or anything like that.
My name is James. I've lived down this street for 30 years.
I'm Claire Watson and I've lived in Portman Avenue for 14 years.
Santina Watson and I've lived here 15 years.
Claire's mum.
My name's Lizzie Calf and I've lived on Portman Avenue for 10 years.
Massive, massive bang that we heard.
And the next thing I can remember is my brother said to me, Claire, he said, you need to wake up. He said, there's a man in the street and he's dead.
We opened the curtains and there's this guy laying right there on the pavement.
Hello, police emergency.
Hello, we've just been ordered to church down Portman Avenue in Mortlake and we've come across what looks like a dead body. It may be a hoax, but we thought we ought to let you know. It looks like blood. Very extraordinary.
It looked like there was no face left. His head had split open.
We thought, first of all, that he had been bludgeoned, murdered, in fact.
You said there's blood in near to the body, or what you think might be a body?
Yeah.
Okay, we'll be there within minutes. We're on our way.
I'm Jeremy Alsop. I'm a detective sergeant at Richmond Police Station, which is part of the Met Police. My first thoughts when I looked across the road was, it looked worse than like a shooting.
Worse than a shooting?
Worse than a shooting because of the way his body was. You know, his head had a serious injury. Perhaps he's been hit with something hard or shot, and that's just the way he's landed on the floor. Or he's been shot somewhere else or hit somewhere else and dumped there by a car. The officer that was first there had preliminarily searched the body and found a mobile phone and a SIM card that we looked at, and it was of a SIM card that we hadn't noticed or didn't recognise the provider, and also the gentleman had some Angolan currency in his pocket. None of it added up. African guy, African appearing male, tissue in his ears which we could see, and apparently, although I didn't see it, he had green grease over his clothing.
The noise, when I was at university, somebody fell from 20th floor and the noise was described as a door being dropped from a height, and that's what it sounded like.
When I saw the body and the way it was laying, the immediate thought that comes to my head was he's fallen out of a plane because of the thud I'd heard, and because previously there's been incidents in this area where stowaways have fallen out of planes.
We're in a flight path. I saw them keep looking up at the sky, in fact, and that's how we realised.
I think it's a bit of silence, really, just people looking up, and then it's sort of everyone thinking the same thing, looking down, looking at the gentleman again. Some checks were done with the airport, and it just so happens he had Angolan currency, and at that very time, a BA flight had been going overhead to land at Heathrow from Luanda in Angola. So it was all there, really. And yeah, the penny dropped, and people just looking up, thinking, well, this is awful.
So we know this was someone who'd stowed away in the undercarriage of a flight coming from Angola and then fallen into this street as the wheels were lowered on approach to landing. There have been around a dozen cases of people stowing away on flights to London since the late 1990s, but only two of those have survived. So the question is why he took this extraordinary risk, and of course, who he was, because he had no identity documents on him, no passport, and his face had suffered horrendous injuries on impact. So that was the first challenge for the British authorities.
It's just a really, really thin kind of material that you can't see through the skin.
Like a surgical thread?
Yeah. It just gives an altogether better appearance on the reconstruction. So this was used for the laceration to this gentleman's face. My name's Kiri. I am a technician within the mortuary. An anatomical pathology technician is our normal term. We are the ones that reconstruct the bodies to try and make them look as they did in life and try and make them look normal again, which this poor guy obviously didn't when he came in. Usually, when we reconstruct the head is packed out with material, maybe cotton wool, to absorb and to just give the shape of the skull back. With this gentleman, I think I reconstructed from inside out, in as much as through the skull, to try and pack the face out a little bit, to try and construct the bones.
And in this kind of case, when you have someone like that, what clues are there to you as to what they used to look like?
None at all. Sometimes you can get a passport photo, or you can get a recent photo to work with, so that you kind of know their face shape and know what you need to do to make them look like that again.
Of course, in this case, there was no ID documents or anything.
No, there was nothing with this poor lad.
And so what do? You just basically look at the skin that's there and the bones that are there?
Yeah, and just match up the skin, and then once you've got everything stitched, then you can start trying to mould the bones that are no longer fixed bones. Then you can kind of, with your hands, move the face around, and kind of you get different shapes to the face, of oval to, you know, wider or longer. And I put him to what I thought he may look like.
Even I was shocked when that photograph was sent to me. That it's a picture of the gentleman now, after he's had his post-mortem, his face has been reconstructed, and he's certainly recognisable. He's got a very nasty scar which has been stitched up across his forehead. But I would have thought that anyone seeing that who knew this gentleman would say, yeah, I know that person.
That's absolutely extraordinary, isn't it? From when he'd landed on the pavement and his head was pretty much destroyed, he looks almost as if he's asleep.
He does. That's the first thing I thought when I looked at it. Apart from the fact that he's got this very nasty scar across his forehead, you would say that guy was just asleep on a bed.
So he looks like he's in his mid-20s. He's got a little bit of beard on his chin. Yes. Otherwise, apart from that, he's clean-shaven. He's got quite closely cropped hair.
He has got quite a distinctive tattoo on his left arm.
That's what we're looking at now.
To me, it looks like a Z and a G. Just above his left elbow.
I mean, it could possibly be the initials of his name.
It could be. But at the moment, that's all we've got. We've got the photograph and the tattoo on his arm, along with his phone and DNA and dental records. Working on the principle, he was from Angola because of the currency, the telephone having an African SIM card, and the fact that the BA flight was flying overhead. And it's to provide all that information to the Angolan authorities to see whether they can tell us who he is. It's in the hands of us, the police, with their authorities there. And as yet, there's been no identification.
So nothing's come back from the Angolan side?
Back, no.
That's a BA. They all come in from the east, flying into the wind. Funny enough, when the incident happened, the poor guy fell from the plane, I kept looking up, you know, thinking, is somebody else going to drop out that undercarriage, you know? And I thought of that guy. Other people did as well, because they put flowers down for him.
We put a rose there, and some of the people put lilies, and there were other small bunches of flowers. Somebody wrote a poem. I can't remember the words of it, but it was like the man that fell to earth or something.
If they can't identify him, and if he's, you know, buried over here, and then his family are never going to know what happened to him.
Maybe he's never identified. The best lead I think we have is his mobile phone, which unfortunately we can't access because it's locked. And we need a code from that service provider. So another thing we've asked for is for the Angolan authorities to approach the phone company and say, look, how do we unlock this phone? How do we find out who are the names stored in his phone? Who was calling him? Who he was calling? It could be as simple as saying one says mum, or one says dad, or one says sister, or something like that. And that will probably provide our best lead.
And have you heard anything back from
Not
that?
Not yet, no.
So frustrating.
Very frustrating, yes.
What could have made him do it? I mean, If you offered me, £5 million, I wouldn't do that. You know, what must have been going through his mind to do that? I really would like to know why he did it.
Well, I would like to know. I would like to know. Just so that you can understand, really, what makes people take such big risks just to get out of their country. No. Awful, what an awful thing to do, you have to go through.
I'm Alison Thompson. I've been a coroner in West London for nearly 14 years and have dealt with five or six similar cases of stowaways falling from aircraft. It's the sort of case that upsets everybody that comes into contact with it, I think, because you feel that they had such high hopes of finding a different life here. You don't know whether somebody's given them poor information by saying, actually, you'll be fine, you know, you'll be able to breathe normally and it'll be warm up there. You just don't know what the background is and whether people have taken advantage of them. Our primary task is to ensure that everything is done to try to identify this gentleman as a matter of urgency. Sadly, in some deaths, there does come a time when we are unable to identify people and we have to consider laying them to rest in a respectful way. And what we do in cases like that where we've got no family is we ask the relevant local authority to arrange a funeral. We don't like having to do that and register a death in an unknown name. And I think we owe it to the family, who we may someday discover, to ask all the right questions now.
Well, I've just had a call and there's been a breakthrough, it appears. We know that the stowaway's Angolan phone was locked, but I've now been told that the police found a second SIM card tucked inside the pocket of his jeans. So I'm heading back to see Detective Allsup of the Metropolitan Police. Detective, what can you tell me about what's happened?
What's happened is I'm now in possession of a telephone number where he's shared a text message with, some stored telephone numbers in his address book, only seven, and some last numbers called. The interesting thing is one of the numbers stored in his address book and the number where there's been a swapping of text message is a Swiss number. So that gives me a potential lead.
And so have you called that number yet?
I have tried to call that number. Unfortunately, it just rings out. I'm not able to leave a message or speak to anyone. It might be it's an old card, an old number, and I don't get any answer at all.
I've come now to an airfield in Surrey, about an hour or so outside London. This is a decommissioned Boeing 747. This is how he would have got onto the plane, climbing up onto one of these rear wheels when no one was watching, and then he would have had to jump up onto the wheel housing like this and then up into the wheel well, like I'm doing now, into the undercarriage and now inside. And already you get an idea of just how cramped it is in here. He would have had to find a place in which to wedge himself. And as the plane picked up speed towards takeoff, you can imagine the noise in here, the vibrations. We know that he took small pieces of tissue paper and crammed them in his ears, but I can't imagine that would have provided much protection. And then as the plane took off, the wheels would have retracted into this space, taking up most of it. These doors then would have closed and he would have been sealed in. Even just after spending a few moments in here, I'm already starting to feel claustrophobic, so I can't help wondering what started to go through his mind. At that point, the temperature would have been plummeting fast, the oxygen in the air would have becoming less and less, and I wonder whether at that point he realised that he'd made a terrible mistake, that there was no way out, there was no turning back. So it's now the 21st of December and I'm back with the Metropolitan Police because there's been another breakthrough in the case. I'm here once again with Detective Sergeant Jeremy Allsop. So Detective, what can you tell us?
Well, the latest is, I think last time we spoke, I mentioned about a SIM card that was found in the gentleman's pocket. The interesting thing about it was one of the calls was a Swiss mobile number. Now, a few times I did try ringing that number, it just rang out. But out of the blue, last week, that number rang me while I was sat at work one evening. I answered the phone and spoke to a lady who told me that she was half Swiss, half English, so she spoke perfectly good English as a young lady.
He said that there was a stowaway and that he, basically, that he'd fallen out of the plane.
It was quite a strange call because at first it seemed clear to me she knew nothing about what I was talking about, and she was sort of saying, well, why are you asking me? Why would I know about this? I don't understand about a stowaway. What do you mean?
I didn't really understand what he was talking about. But as soon as he said that the plane came from Angola, I knew straight away who it was.
And it was slightly distressing. Almost without any warning whatsoever, she sort of snapped. She knew who this guy was, and she started to cry, and she said, I know who this person is, I know who this person is.
I know who it is. I know who it is. And I cried.
What she told me was, in 2010, she was living in South Africa with her family. Now, whilst they were there, they employed a housekeeper, stroke gardener. And it's this person, the girl from Switzerland, believes is the stowaway.
A man whose body was found in a street in Mortlake in West London after falling to the ground from the undercarriage of a plane has been identified. He was Mozambican national José Matata. His identity was established from a SIM card found in his jeans.
My name is Jessica, Jessica in English. I was a former employer of José Matata. Joseph had a really hard life, and he used to confide in me when we were gardening. And his dad died of an illness, so he's probably 5 or 6 at this point. After his father dying, there were floods in Mozambique, in his area. He told me they were, scavenging for food, but in water.
What kind of person was José? How would you describe him?
He had a really soft manner about him. So everything he did was really gentle. Everything he did in my house was patient, and he was straightforward. He didn't talk much, but if he did talk, it was meant something. He wasn't afraid of much. I don't think I've ever really seen him afraid. We talk about music as well. That was something he was interested in. I made him listen to Manu Chao one day. Me gusta la montaña, me gusta tu. And he used to love like the acoustic and the music behind it. He used to say that that's our music. He was really a free spirit and light-spirited. It was lovely to have him around.
This is where the story gets more complicated, because as we talked, it started to become clear that the relationship between José and Jessica was much closer than just that of a boss and her employee.
Well, he converted to Islam, so he was a Muslim, and I'm a convert to Islam, I'm a Muslim. After he finished working for me, we travelled together. I went with him to Mozambique. We grew very close to one another. We were like family, and also brother and sister in Islam. I was trying to help him or find work for him. I knew that his family didn't have a lot of means. Also, I cared for him, and I'd known him now for several years, and he was really like my family. When I came back to Europe, the first thing I did when I came out of the plane was send money to him. So I sent him quite a lot of money at this point so that he could follow through all the steps which are needed to obtain a visa. I was willing to help him come to Europe if that was what he wanted.
But the problem for José was that he had little prospect of getting a visa legally. So Jessica says he turned to a corrupt official in Mozambique who promised to get him false papers.
Unfortunately, the person that he entrusted in these official offices just left him standing there. Like, they said, come back another day, but when he came back, that person had disappeared with all the money, and there was no hope for him because he'd lost that money.
So José Matada now decided to try a different route. He travelled from the Mozambican capital, Maputo, back to South Africa, and then, a few months later, overland through Botswana and Zambia to Angola. At this point, Jessica says, newly married and pregnant, she didn't have the means to help him.
When he just arrived in Angola, he called me. And he said that he was going to Luanda.
That's the capital of Angola.
Yeah. And he asked me if I could send him some money at that point, but I didn't have any money to send him.
And you know why he went to Angola, why he decided to go to Luanda?
I think he went to Angola because it is renowned in the southern part of Africa that many people go to Europe from Angola. When he called me, I told him to take it easy, to find a place, ask around, try and find work. But then, obviously, I don't know what happened after that.
And this is where the trail goes cold, because this last phone call between José and Jessica was just a few days before he stowed away on the plane. We don't know why he decided to take that risk, whether perhaps he paid someone to get him onto the tarmac, and that person duped him by telling him that he'd be safe. Jessica only realised what had happened when the British police contacted her.
I was in shock. I was 8 months pregnant at this point, so I just lied down for about 48 hours and I didn't move. I just stayed lying down and I tried not to cry too much. I didn't want to lose my baby, but I was really, really deeply upset about it. I just thought, oh, Joseph, what have you done? Why did you get into that plane? Why weren't you more patient?
Well, the inquest into the death of José Matada has now been held here in London, and the verdict was, as we expected, he died due to an accident. But what struck me were the details that came out about how he died, because although in most cases stowaways are killed by the cold and the lack of oxygen, according to the pathologist in this case, Dr. Robert Chapman, José in fact survived for most and perhaps all of the flight.
In this case, there were some indications that his heart might have been working to some extent when he struck the ground. I mean, I believe he was very close to death, but he may have had some heart activity when he struck the ground because there was some bruising around some of the injuries.
So we can't be sure he was dead when he hit the ground?
We can't be sure he was dead when he actually struck the ground. I think it's very likely he was, but there's some evidence that there was some heart activity when he hit the ground, I think.
Well, this is where José Matada has been buried, Twickenham Cemetery in West London. And at this point in the early English summer, everything is a deep, lush green, and there's a mass of wildflowers that have sprung up between the graves. The police here in London have been in touch with officials in Mozambique, but have been told that they found no trace of José. And that means that, as far as we know, his family are still not yet aware of what's happened to him.
I know the tattoo he had on his arm. He had a G and a Z, and the Z stood for Zuze, and that's how his mum used to call him. So it was José, but she used to call him Zuze. And I also know he's got a brother living in Maputo. So far, they haven't found him yet.
Yeah, I thought about the parents of that person. I thought, as a mother myself, how I would feel not knowing, just maybe even hoping that he had got a better life somewhere else, and potentially they might even feel that, you know, they're waiting for a letter or waiting for a phone call, waiting for something, and of course now they're never going to get anything.
He was desperate, you know. I would have welcomed him if he would have got in, because if he was desperate enough to do that, well, good luck to him. I want to pat him on the back and say, well done, mate, you know, you've made it. You deserve it.
I said to my husband, if Joseph doesn't go to paradise, then none of us are going. Because he was so good. He was such a good soul. And because he'd been through so much in his life.
There's nothing to mark the grave here. It's just a small patch of brown earth amongst the freshly cut grass. Someone's laid a bunch of flowers. It's not clear who, but there's nothing else here. There's no headstone, nothing with his name on, nothing giving his date of birth. But we know now that José Matarda was born on the 9th of September, 1986. He died here in London, just a few miles from this spot, on the 9th of September, 2012, his 26th birthday.
The Man Who Fell to Earth was produced and presented by Rob Walker. The programme was first broadcast in assignment on the BBC World Service in June this year. Unfortunately, since that time, there's still been no contact or further information about other members of José Matata's family. The BBC.